Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. I'm Eli Mazur, and today we're lucky to be joined by Jean Quinn, the founder of IP Watchdog. It has been the leading online publication focused on intellectual property for almost 20 years. Thank you so much for joining, Jean.
Sure, no problem, Eli, anytime.
I want to, of course, talk about a lot of the big IP issues, but first I want to tell the story about IP Watchdog. You hear a lot of these days about struggling media organizations, and you guys are about to celebrate your 20th anniversary. You just hired a new editor-in-chief. What do you think is responsible for your success?
Well, one of the things that I think has been most responsible for my success, not only here in with IP Watchdog, but with my success in various other areas, is I have really gone into a lot of different opportunities, I guess you might say, not realizing that I probably should fail, you know, and then just working really hard to get it done, to get it succeed. And, you know, there's no substitute for hard work, number one. And then trying to find where there's a niche and where there's opportunity, like any business, right? You know, you don't want to redo what somebody else is doing. You want to find out what you do, what you can contribute, and what you can bring to the table, and then do it and hopefully enjoy doing it and do more of it. You know, and that's what we've done. You know, I do understand why the media is struggling. You know, yeah. It costs a lot of money to actually deliver the news, you know, and what we've learned at IP Watchdog is people really today, for better or for worse, don't want news. You know, they don't want that, and that's probably why you see so many shows on cable news that are not really news.
Yeah.
They're analysis. And, you know, so that's one of the things that we always did. And that was one of the things that I did very early on to kind of separate me from others, because I didn't want to do a blog. You know, I didn't want to write what I had for breakfast or this or that. And one of the things I started doing was, for about 4 years, I had the inside back cover of Patent World. And that was 800 to 900 words a month. So I kind of got familiar with drafting news stories or op-eds, and I guess it was in that word length.
I'm sorry, Patent World, was that a magazine?
Yeah, yeah, that's a magazine that was out of the UK. So I was I was the US voice.
Yeah.
And I had a very favorable inside back cover position, you know, yeah. So it was this kind of op-ed plays.
Right.
And I commented on what was going on in the US or even around the world, you know, and it was 800 to 900 words, and I got comfortable writing at that length. And so it wasn't really blog length. It was, you know, it was say a little bit about the facts, but then get to the analysis. And that's what people really want. People want to know what they should be focusing on. And a lot of times it's because people, some of them like me and they agree with me, and then some people disagree with me and they want to know what I think so that they can disagree with me. And that's perfectly fine. You know,
yeah.
I think it's great fun to have a point of view. And that's one of the things I think in law school too often, you know, you get beat out of you, you know, it's, you can't have a point of view. It's got to be vanilla. And I just don't like vanilla. And lucky enough, that's what people want to hear, is they want to hear a point of view, because I think it helps them figure out what they actually believe.
Yeah.
Do they agree with you or do they disagree with you?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's definitely something IP Watchdog, like how you guys separate yourselves, is that you do have a voice, you do have opinions. And this, like you said, it's the opposite for most patent attorneys who are very conservative and don't want to upset anybody. Did you have any concerns that you'll be airing all these opinions and a lot of people won't like?
No.
You won't be able to be employed again?
Absolutely not. And, you know, okay, so this was also very fortuitous. My first legal job was as a general civil litigator. We did litigation for everything. You had a litigation issue, the firm I was with had a litigation solution for you. So I found that, and this was up in New Hampshire, and I worked for one of the partners, and he was the chair of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire,
yeah.
And he ran for Congress a few times. And one of the other partners who I worked for very frequently, he was a Republican and in the state house and in the leadership in the state house. And I noticed very early on that, you know, I was like, huh, the people who are hiring Joe tend to be Democrats and tend to be people who he has something in common with. And the people who are hiring Dave tend to be Republicans, and they tend to have something that they have in common with him.
Yeah.
And they used it as a business development tool. It's like, this is who I am.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't like me, that's fine, perfectly fine. You don't have to like me. You know, I'm a very good attorney, and they obviously worked for people who they didn't share political views with. But they worked a lot of times with their network and the people who did like them. And it seemed like a natural affinity. So I always try and tell younger attorneys, don't be afraid to be yourself, because clients know when you're not yourself. And they won't know exactly why they don't trust you or why they don't like you.
Yeah.
But I think 9 times out of 10, it's because you're wearing a mask and it's not who you really are. You know, and I've seen people in our space, you know, Eli, there's all kinds of people who are just nerdy geeks. I'm a nerdy geek. I mean, you know, and wear it with a badge of honor, because there's a lot of nerdy geeks that need patent work. And a lot of them read comic books just like I do. They watch, you know, The Flash and Arrow and their Batman, you know, and they like the Marvel Universe too. And you might have something in common with them. And they've coded up stuff and they've deleted stuff after working all night in the lab just like you did too. So I think I embraced that. So yeah. I was never afraid to say who I was and what I really believed.
So it seems like you were working in a very exciting place. But what made you decide to go, I guess, into patent law?
So I'm an electrical engineer. Yeah. And when I went to law school young. And I kind of went to law school to escape my electrical engineering. Yeah. You know, I always...
Like a lot of patent attorneys.
Yeah, right. I always tell people I was never going to set the world on fire as an electrical engineer unless it was quite literally setting the world on fire. So then I went to law school when I was 21, which, you know, is not extremely young, but it's a little on the young side. Yeah. And then you see that they want the first jobs you're interviewing for, they want you to be in the top 25% of your law school class and the top 25% of your undergraduate class. And it's like, well, I was in the top 10% of my law school class and I was in the top 100% of my undergraduate.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not quite that bad, but you know, it was, so I'm like, well, I'm never going to escape it. So I liked doing litigation. It seemed like it in law school as much as you can know, right?
Right.
So I did that knowing that I could always go back and fall back on patents. And then I wound up doing that. Just a couple of years later, I wound up, you know, studying for the patent bar, and I went back up to Franklin Pierce where I had gotten my degree, and I got my LLM and IP, and then that's all she wrote.
Can you tell us a story, I guess, after you went back to school, you were a professor at a lot of different law schools, but you started an IP watchdog back in 1999, which is like... around the same time, just right after Google started. And
I mean, I'm at the dawn of the internet, really. I mean, not like, you know, the very beginning, you know, back in like 1996-ish or whenever. But I bought the name in 1998, and it was me and a bunch of other guys I was getting my LLM with. And we had this, what we called this think tank, and we got together every week, and we talk about our plan to dominate the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it was the .com. Error, you know, at the beginning of the .com, right? I mean, everybody was going to become filthy rich. All you need was a .com. So I had bought ipwatchdog.com, and our collective idea was we were going to evaluate stocks based on their IP portfolio. And not that it was going to be, you know, oh, buy this company, sell that company, but it would be like a piece to the puzzle. Because, you know, like if you have enough indicators saying buy, then buy. If you have enough indicators saying sell, then sell.
Yeah.
So we were hoping to be an indicator.
Yeah.
And then everybody that was involved in this plan went and got hired here, hired there, hired everywhere. And then I'm left, you know, and I had the name, and
that explains the name, I guess.
Yeah. And so then I started teaching from place to place, and I started just putting up the stuff I would write. And it was about probably 2001 when I realized, I was just looking at I don't even know why I was doing it. I was looking at our Sturver statistics.
Yeah.
And I realized there was like over 10,000 people a month reading just my random thoughts I was putting up. And I'm like, you know, I can probably turn this into
And initially business. It was for your students to use.
Yeah. And but there was obviously a whole lot more people than the students finding it. You know, and back then it was, Google wasn't, you know, I mean, it was Alta Vista.
Interesting.
It was probably the big one. And, you know, the big search engine of the day. That's a name from the past. I don't even know that they probably don't even exist anymore.
I guess you realized a lot of people are visiting, and then did you decide, well, I'll start putting more content up and see what happens?
Yeah. Well, what I did was I figured, okay, so I graduated law school in 1995, so it's 2001. So I'm in the area of being, you know, probably like a, you know, senior associate, junior partner type.
Yeah.
You know, what can I do legitimately that people would read, right?
Yeah.
So I spent so much time summarizing cases.
Yeah.
Because I worked when I was in New Hampshire, I was the only associate at a 10-partner law firm. So lots of chiefs, not a lot of Indians, you know, and as the saying goes in New Hampshire, that's just the way the law firms are up there.
Right.
So I would summarize these cases all the time for them, and they'd, you know, do memos and all that. So I thought, well, you know, I can read these cases and say what they are. So I would summarize, I literally read every IP case in America on the district court level and on the appellate level.
And at that time, how did you get the decisions?
LexisNexis.
Okay.
And I would summarize them in one paragraph.
Yeah.
And copyrights, trademarks, trade secrets and patents.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then in early 2000s, it wasn't like it is today.
Right.
There was much fewer of them, much fewer.
Yeah.
At least the ones that you could get your hands on. So I summarized them and I sent out a weekly newsletter, you know, and it was, and then I would put them up on the website, you know, and then I'd be taking these things here and there and then creating pages to describe various things and stuff. But it was all HTML static, you know. Yeah. Things really didn't hit, you know, the afterburner until the blogging platforms came along.
So who was your target audience at the time? Did you think it was other IP associates? Did you hope it was would be potential clients, or what were you thinking?
Well, it was potential clients for sure. It was IP attorneys. And, you know, I can't say as I really had a plan. I had more of a belief,
yeah,
you know, that what I was doing was going to wind up being worthwhile because, you know, there's so much of what you do, particularly at the beginning of your career, where you're trying to build a name for yourself and build expertise. And I knew even if I didn't figure out exactly how to turn this into a quote-unquote business,
yeah,
that it was going to be beneficial just because more people were going to know who I was. And then little by little, more people did find me and want me to do legal work for them. So I've got a lot of legal work through IP Watchdog over the years.
And I guess at what point, was there a certain point when you decided, I'm just going to focus on IP Watchdog and, you know, leave that all those chiefs behind?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I was teaching and going from place to place. And then I met Renee probably in about 2002.
Who's your wife?
Who's my wife now.
And she's works for IP Watchdog.
And she's my, well, I sometimes say I work for her.
Okay.
She's the glue that holds the office together.
Yeah.
And she didn't really want to move around a lot, and things were growing. And I had I had told the dean at Syracuse University where I was teaching what I really thought. So I didn't get fired.
Yeah.
But because I was on a contract from the state.
Yeah.
But she doubled my workload and cut my salary in half. So I quit. You know? And it was probably a year ahead of what I had planned. And then that was in 2005, and I just never looked back.
I guess one, obviously we talked about your voice. You're associated with having a very, I guess, pro-patent voice.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a story about, I guess, when did you first hear about patents? What was your impression of them? And did you always have the same, I guess, outlook about patent issues as you have now?
You know, I guess I did. I mean, my uncle was an inventor. He had 6 patents. He never made any money on them. So
so you had a realistic view of them.
Yeah, so I have a realistic view of patents. You know, and I tell my client, I talk about my uncle all the time, you know, because he actually, in one of his inventions, he sold police equipment.
Yeah.
And so, and he was, for a period of time, an official in the International Chiefs of Police organization.
Yeah.
So he had was playing golf with some general from, this is the story, I don't know whether this is true or not, but some general from the Pentagon, and he was telling my uncle, you know, this is what we need. We need some kind of, like, it had something to do with grenade launchers.
Yeah.
So my uncle spent 6 months, figured out, filed a patent application, went back and told this guy who he had met playing golf, I've got the solution to your problem, and delivered exactly what this guy asked for.
Yeah.
And there had been a paradigm shift in the 6 months that ensued. And it's like, oh, yeah, you know, we would have bought those if you had it back when we were playing golf. But we're not interested in them anymore, you know. So there's just the invention part of patents is the easiest part because it's the only thing the inventor can really control.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm really interested in patents from a business standpoint, you know. I mean, because I think it's really cool and interesting to invent stuff, but it's what really helps the businesses get off the ground, you know.
And you're talking about, I guess, startups and investment.
Yeah, and that's really where all my work has really been with startup companies and trying to help them and get investment and then grow. And so, like, if you were to ask me, people always ask me, what's the coolest stuff you've ever worked on?
Yeah.
The coolest stuff I've ever worked on is usually stuff that most people wouldn't think is all that particularly cool, because I find it cool because of the story.
Yeah.
You know, like this wakeboard that's right here, right behind us.
Yeah.
I've worked with this inventor, and who's become a friend now, since he first started back in 07, 08.
Oh, wow.
You know, and now he's been on Shark Tank, and, you know, and now his company is probably worth about, it's got to be worth at least $5 to $10 million company. Yeah. And he's doing a couple million dollars a year on wakeboards and accessories, yeah. You know, and it's all because of a patent.
Yeah.
You know, and we got him one patent, and then he got a couple more patents, and then the product is great and people like it and hard work, and he's a good person, you know, and people want to buy from him, and it does really great stuff, and he's just done business right. He's got some people, the inventor of the original wakeboard is on his board of directors.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so this is, you know, when you get a client like that, they can start from, I need to file a provisional application, to now he's, you know, on his way to really building a really special company. That's exciting to me.
So that's interesting. I think that explains your views in terms of the way you see the patent system is through the eyes of these startup founders and inventors, and you realize what a crucial piece the patents play in their,
absolutely,
in their company.
Absolutely. And the first patent we got from him, one I wrote, I didn't prosecute it. They lost at the Federal Circuit.
Yeah.
Because the Federal Circuit said that wakeboard is obvious.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, they're wrong. And Judge Newman dissented, and she was right. There's nothing obvious about it. And it was all about secondary considerations, because he's got video showing big fat people like me, bigger and fatter than me,
yeah,
getting up on this wakeboard. An old grandmother, 80 years old, getting up on that wakeboard. Now, if you're not a big fat guy like me, you don't know. You're not supposed to be able to get up on a wakeboard.
Right, right.
This wakeboard is different.
Yeah.
It is special. You know, and sometimes I think I look at these judges and it's like, did you actually read what was filed? Did you actually read the patent? Did you actually take the time to think about the invention? Because a big guy like myself that tries to get up on an every other wakeboard that's out there spends all day getting dragged around the water until my arms are too tired because the boat can't go fast enough and the wakeboard isn't designed well enough for me to get up.
Yeah.
But this is a wakeboard everybody can get up on.
Yeah.
You know, there's something special. And if there's something special, that's supposed to mean it's not obvious.
Right, right.
And that story, and I see that a lot. And it's one thing if it happens to, you know, like the Qualcomms or the IBMs of the world who have, you know, more money to hire and fight until they win.
Right.
But when it's the smaller inventor who's trying to build the company, and America is built on, for better or for worse, it's built on small companies hiring real people who need jobs.
Yeah.
And it's the startup companies that hire the most people. I'm getting worked up.
No. And I think this explains your passion and the story
it
behind
it. It does. And that's the perfect example. Yeah. That's one of the really good examples.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that you do is you not only express your opinion, but you call out people who you think have gotten things wrong.
Some of them, my friends.
So I was going to ask you, are you ever concerned that people will take it personally? Or do you think the issues that you're talking about are more important than that? I guess, how do you weigh all that?
I mean, sometimes I used to worry about it. I mean, I don't really worry about it. I mean, I'm sure some people do take it personally. The one thing I do remember when I met Judge Michelle for the first time, I remember calling Renee and telling her, I'm so sorry about everything I've ever written about the Federal Circuit, you know, because he's such a really nice guy.
Right, right,
but I've had conversations with him, and I've gotten to know him really quite well over the years since he's left the court. And he read what he thought was legitimate criticism, not just the screaming and hollering. And that helped inform him. So I would hope that kind of tries to, you know, people will help inform themselves by it. But I don't know. All I can do is be myself, I suppose.
You know? I mean, you would hope at least Federal Circuit judges would be, you know, more mature than
I'm sure that they are. They probably don't like reading when I say certain things, you know. And sometimes I maybe go over the top. I was just so, like last week, I was just extremely frustrated, and somebody sent me an email and quoted me back at myself and said, "Well, I'm not trying to make any friends at the Federal Circuit, are you?" And it's no. I mean, I don't understand for the life of me how can something that actually has a physical, tangible presence be abstract?
Yeah,
it can't. I mean, it just can't be.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's illogical. And then the one that's even more illogical is, it can be novel and non-obvious, yet not be inventive. I mean, that's just idiotic. Now, they're clearly not explaining themselves properly. Now, if they want to say that software is not patent eligible, why don't they just say it? You know, don't force us to act like, I guess I'm stuttering here now. What I'm trying to say is, don't force the rest of us
right.
to believe your illogical nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, if what you want to say is software is not patent eligible, say it.
Right.
Don't act like we have to believe something that's stupid and, oh, this is great. You're so wise. This is so thoughtful. No, it's garbage is what it is.
And I was going to talk about it a little later. So obviously after the Alice Supreme Court decision came out, which put into question patentability, what's patent eligible and what's not, a lot of people were saying, you know, software patents are dead. How do you think that's played out? It seems like you think that there's a lot of confusion.
There's
a lot of disagreement. How would you define that?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, I go back and forth, I suppose. You know, like, I thought we were hitting our stride, and I thought we had figured things out. And then, you know, the last handful of cases from the Federal Circuit, I mean, what they just said over the last couple of weeks, that a garage door is abstract.
Yeah.
I mean, how is a garage door opener abstract? I mean, I guess what they're trying to say is that the wireless component can't be what is new, or I mean, but it just seems like they're saying such things that are just bizarre, you know. And I mean, nobody wants to notice that in order to say if that's correct, then there's another well understood black letter statement of patent law that has to now be false. I mean, so we were told you can never dissect claims. Every claim limitation has to have a meaning and you can't ignore them.
Yeah.
Well, they're clearly ignoring claim limitations.
Yeah.
You know, so which one is it? You know, we can't act like all of these things can be fit together in harmony because they can't.
Right.
And we're looking to the Federal Circuit for answers and they're not giving us any answers. So unfortunately, I think we're in this place where the best thing that we can do is tell the clients, look, things are going to change. You know, we've never been able to give the same advice for more than a couple years in software.
Right.
Whether it's with obviousness changes, patent eligibility changes, the way the patent office handles it changes. So what you file today is going to get examined under a different set of rules and laws.
Right.
So you need to give us enough time and money to be able to do the best practice that we can come up with today that we think will pass muster then. Because if you don't file today, you're never going to get it tomorrow. I mean, that's the only thing we know. But where are we? I mean, if you had asked me this a couple months ago at the beginning of the summer, I would have been pretty optimistic. But after some of these decisions that have come out this summer, I'm not nearly as optimistic.
I mean, I guess the argument that at least I've heard from the proponents of the current state of patent eligibility is they say, well, you know, if you actually look at the statistics, the number of, you know, reversals on 101 are actually less than they are in 102 and 103. And there's always disagreements within the Federal Circuit, you know, and they, you know, give you 10 other examples. What is your...
Well, I mean, you know, when you can't get a patent, then it's easy to not have reversal. I mean, and part of the other problem too with 101 is, don't forget, so many of these decisions are masked by Rule 36 affirmances.
Yeah.
You know, so we don't know what the panel really thinks.
Oh, I see.
You know, I mean, 50%, and sometimes more than 50% of the Federal Circuit's docket is a Rule 36, which they just affirm.
So that's skewing those.
I think it's totally skewing.
Okay.
You know, I mean, because if you go and you actually look at these decisions, I mean, people are getting slaughtered on 101 out there.
Yeah.
I mean, because district courts are killing 101 patents still, or killing patents on 101, and the Federal Circuit's just affirming them. You know, I mean, so the problem isn't getting the patent.
Yeah.
Getting the patent at the patent office has gotten a lot easier.
Right, right.
The problem we're talking about now is keeping it.
Yeah.
Because the federal circuit seems to be back in the business of not seeing a whole lot of patent eligible software out there. And the real travesty, and there's no other word for it. I mean, there's probably many words better suited that are much more severe. I mean, because it's completely inexplicable and inexcusable what they're doing on Rule 36. I mean, it's wrong. And the fact that they're doing it and nobody seems to care and the Supreme Court doesn't seem to care is just mind-boggling. But with so much uncertainty with 101, why are they forfeiting all these opportunities to fine-tune the doctrine?
Right.
Rule 36 is supposed to be used where the outcome is certain and the law is clear.
Right.
Do you think the law is clear in 101?
I don't, but I guess.
And see, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, right. But I don't think anybody could say it's right. Clear, right? I mean, because like going all the way back to Ultramershal and DDR, those are clearly different cases. Yeah. They're the same case with different rulings, yeah. Right? And there's all kinds of those cases right. With software. You know, you tell me which cases the panel is going to find as precedential.
Yeah.
And we can tell you what the outcome is going to be.
Right.
But if you don't know which decisions they're going to deem as precedential, you don't know what the outcome's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, and that is why it's uncertain.
Yeah.
You know, and the law is not supposed to be that way. It's supposed to be predictable.
I guess many people have come to that conclusion that the courts probably can't fix it. That's why we are hearing about this talk about the 101 legislation to clarify that. You've seen a lot of these battles to pass legislation, and I was going to talk about it later, but they had all these hearings. They're planning to release a new draft in September. Where do you see this going? How many more?
Yeah.
Some people seem to think it's around the corner, but what do you think?
Well, it's not. I think it's dead.
It's dead, completely dead.
Completely dead.
Wow.
Because from what I understand, the 112 change is inextricably tied to 101.
Yeah.
And there is a coalition in favor of 101, and half of that coalition will not only not be in favor, but will turn around and actively oppose the legislation if 112 stays a part of it. So if the coalition splits, then it's got no chance. And the problem is this, you know, like if you read the 101, or I'm sorry, the 112 language.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be a fairly fair representation, a general statement of what the law is after Williamson versus Citrix.
Right.
The question, though, is are they trying to codify Williamson or are they trying to go further?
Right. And whatever court's going to do. Right.
But what I've heard is the Senate thinks they're going further.
Yeah.
They want to go further than Williamson.
Right.
Well, so now what people think is all they're going to do is they're going to take the 101 rejections and move them into 112.
Right.
Now, for my money, I'd be okay with that. I don't think that's right. I think that's stupid. It's bad. But at least it should get you past a motion to dismiss.
Yeah.
You know, and if you get past a motion to dismiss, which I can't believe we're talking about that now.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in law school, you would have been laughed out of the classroom as you know, just not getting it if you think we're thinking about getting past a motion to dismiss. But if you can get past a motion to dismiss, maybe at least you have some chance to have some kind of settlement negotiations.
Yeah.
But and then if it's 112, you should be able to get to a claim construction. But there's a lot of people that think that if all 101 is going to do is put it into 112, then it's not going to be any better.
Yeah. And I want to get back to some of these issues, but I guess I want to talk a little bit more about IP Watchdog itself. Actually, I talked to a prominent lobbyist a few years ago, and she said that even though people on Capitol Hill and on Key Street don't always like what you write, they're always reading what you're writing. And I've heard similar things in the patent office.
Yeah.
I guess, when did you start realizing that not only other IP practitioners are following what you're writing, but you know, very influential policymakers, like you mentioned, judges like Judge Michel are reading and following closely what you have to say?
I'll say that I kind of did know that pretty early on, and I won't name the judge because I don't know whether that judge would like me to name them, but I was, you know, I teach a patent bar review course.
Yeah.
And I was teaching a patent bar review course, and one of this judge's clerks was present,
Oh.
And during one of the breaks, the judge said in front of a classroom full of people, identified himself and said, oh, the judge reads you first thing every morning,
yeah,
every day. And I thought to myself, wow. You know, wow.
That,
I
mean, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool, you know. And then since then, that judge has told Renee that, you know, they read. And that's pretty cool to know that, you know, there's people at the Federal Circuit that read you.
Yeah.
And, you know, Judge Michelle has told me he I know he reads IP Watchdog now. And he I guess, apparently was reading it when he was on the court, unbeknownst to me. You know, and I do know we get traffic from a lot of different places. And I always used to joke about, you know, I don't know whether it's the White House keeping their eye on me. Or, you know, but, you know, we get traffic from a lot of different locations, you know. And it's pretty cool to see, I have to say. But, you know, I'm speechless, I guess, you know, and that usually doesn't happen, you know, because I'm just Gene, you know. I'm a patent attorney that isn't afraid to say what I really think, you know.
Did that have an influence, I guess, on how, you know, what you wrote about, what topics you wrote about, or, you know, how you approached IP Watchdog? Or
yeah, it certainly did. I mean, because not so much the topics, but, you know, like if you look at, and I hope people don't do this, but if you go and look at some stuff I wrote a long time ago. One, it wasn't terribly good. You know, every once in a while, I'll stumble on something I have saved that I wrote, I don't know, 15 years or more ago. And it's just, it's painful to even look at, you know. And there was also sometimes such animus, I think, you know.
Yeah.
And part of that is, you know, even though I was taught this very early on as a lawyer, you know, sometimes you forget this. Is the one lawyer who literally broke me in told me, don't ever attribute malice when incompetence can explain is an explanation, right?
Yeah.
And it's because people are incompetent. People make mistakes, you know, far more often than they're malicious. Yeah. And sometimes I used to forget that a lot, and I probably still do. And sometimes, you know, you see this narrative unfold in front of you, and it's like, all right, you know, what's going on here? But, you know, I try and make sure the evidence is really, really there and present.
I did notice that you do publish pieces by people who disagree with you.
Yep.
You interview people who disagree with you.
Yep.
Is that a conscious choice? Is that difficult sometimes to do to feature?
No, I mean, it actually, it's interesting. I think a lot of people would find it shocking who I go to lunch with. You know, and some of the people who I disagree with, some of the people who are on the other side, I have very good relationships with, you know, and we don't agree, you know, but that makes it fun, you know, and people who go to the conferences, they know, right? Yeah. I mean, they see us together. They see us out having a drink or as an after party talking and yucking it up like we're old college buddies, right? Yeah. You know, and then we start jabbing at each other, you know, and it is all good and fun game, you know, when we're together like that. But it doesn't change the fact that they believe what they believe and I believe what I believe. It just means that we can get along.
Yeah.
And I think that that's pretty cool that there's people like that in the industry, because it doesn't change the fact that I disagree. And that it doesn't change the fact that what I write about, you know.
I think you touched upon it when you first started IP Watchdog. It really was. There wasn't almost anybody doing what you were doing. But I guess, how would you describe the coverage of IP issues in general? And I'm thinking of even the major media organizations. And how has that really evolved over the last 20 years or so?
Well, first, I think the major media gets IP wrong almost always.
And you're talking more than confusing trademarks and patents?
Or? Yeah, I mean, they do that all the time. You know, there are some outlets, right? You know, like The Hill does pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, but they also allow guest articles, you know, and they, and experts. And Politico and The Hill are both really quite good when they're reporting matter-of-factly about the legislation that's moving and what people are saying and doing and that sort of thing. So that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, so there is some good stuff that's out there, you know, but when you get past that, you know, a lot of the stuff is just really, it's almost like it's drive-by terrible, you know. It's like, so for example, I always tell people, it's like, I tell my students in the patent bar, it's like, you're gonna undoubtedly, now that I'm telling this, notice this, you'll read an article and insert major news publication, some important tech company will have lost some enormously important patent that you didn't even know was getting challenged. And you're going to think to yourself, how could I have possibly missed that this patent, you know, the root of all their commerce was being challenged? And all claims will be lost.
Yeah.
You know, what are they going to do? And it's somebody filed a reexamination, and the first action in the reexamination where the claims were rejected.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're so far away from losing those claims, right? I mean, you got more, another round of rejections and appeals and all kinds of stuff, both internally and externally to the Federal Circuit, you know, and they get stuff so wrong.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing, though, is that back when I first started doing this, you know, you wouldn't see any patent news at all.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was the New York Times would have, like, once a week have one patent article.
Yeah.
Now there's patents in the news all the time. And I think the better patent news is the stuff that you see in the business journals. You know, maybe New York Times, Wall Street Journal, that kind of stuff. Although they get a lot of stuff incorrect too, you know. So I think the thing that you have to do is look at stuff and see, and then, you know, a lot of times people
do you reach out to those reporters?
No. Not really. I mean, I will write about it if it's really egregiously wrong, you know. Like the Fortune did an article a few years ago and they published it, and it was probably, you know, like one of the routine guest contributors wrote that patents were not particularly important to the Industrial Revolution, so why do we need them?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's actually factually incorrect. Patents were regarded as incredibly important for the Industrial Revolution. You know, I mean, so when you're making stuff up, it's not that you got it wrong. It's that you sort of intentionally are telling a tale that kind of suits your needs, you know. And some of the problem is, like, I've talked to some reporters sometimes, and they'll go thinking they have, you know, 1,000 words, and then the next time you talk to them, they cut down to 800 words. And then one time I talked to the guy, says, well, I got cut to 400 words. I got to figure out which 400 words.
So that's the issue.
Yeah.
So now I guess I want to talk more about the landscape of how policy, IP policy is made, since you're in that world. Yeah. I mean, besides IP Watchdog, obviously, who else do you think is influential outside of the courts and the government in really shaping IP policy?
And there's a whole host of people in D.C. that you never hear about or know about that spend a whole lot of time working on IP policy for a whole bunch of different people. Some of them are lobbyists, some of them are attorneys, some of them are just friends of the patent system.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of people that, you know, really, really care about it. And
how does their work, I guess, manifest itself? Is it through lobbying on Capitol Hill?
There's some of that. You know, there's the lobbyists in town that do that.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, the usual suspects that if you need lobbying for your company or for your trade organization, you'll hire maybe at, you know, ACG, you know, or you know, maybe Covington, you know, places like that.
Yeah.
Akin Gump's got some good people there. And there's other places around town that got some good, you know, lobbyists. And then there's a number of people that are just constantly in the know. You know, they're like the people like Todd Dickinson or Bob Stoll. You know, they're the ex-political people, you know, patent office people. And they are lawyers and they represent and they are in D.C. and they, you know, are politically active and they have developed a practice where they can answer questions and help people navigate, you know, whether it be the patent office or things like that, you know. And so there's a lot of really good people in town. I mean, Todd Dickinson is a good name to have if you have a question about policy. He's one I go to a lot, and Bob Stoll is too. You know, those are both really, really good names. You know, and the firms I mentioned, ACG, Covington, Akin Gump, those are all good places.
And I guess one phenomenon that I've noticed is that you know, there's all these trade groups. You know, maybe five or six companies get together, and then they have some alphabet. String some alphabet letters together all of a sudden, and they become this group who represent them. I went through the IP Watchdog archives a little bit, and I saw some interesting ones. There were some, you know, who wanted to weaken the ITC and all that. I mean, what role do they play? Is it more of a PR thing? Is it
a lot of times I think it is a PR thing.
Yeah.
And it sort of has to do, I think, with how long they're going to be around and how committed they are and what kind of investment people are going to make in their longevity and in their mission.
Yeah.
The one thing I think that it's important for people to understand is it doesn't take nearly as much money as most people think it does to influence policy in D.C.
Yeah.
It takes shockingly little money. And it's not the way that most people think it is. And I'm not going to be Pollyannish and say that there's never been a bribe in D.C. and there's not any of that stuff. I mean, yeah. But that's not the way that it goes. It's not the what happens is if you hire somebody to help you out, you know, like a lobbyist or an attorney to talk to somebody to get your message through or represent you, you're hiring somebody who communicates really well and knows the substantive issues very well.
Yeah.
So when they get to talk to staff or members or administrative agency heads or deputies or whoever, they're persuasive.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So if they have those conversations over and over and over and over again, they'll be persuasive over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, and who, you know, there's this old saying about, you know, who's the lawyer's most persuasive? Well, it's the one you heard last. Right. So if you hear this stuff over and over again, and the other side is not talking.
And you're saying the hearing, you're talking about the perspective from the congressman and the people in the agency.
Yeah. So here's the deal. Like, there's all these events. So we're having this event in D.C.
Yeah.
or in Arlington, actually, the SAP event. There's going to be a lot of people there. And there's all kinds of events, not just that we host, but that all kinds of people host. There are events at think tanks. There's events at law firms. There's events at the patent office. There's events everywhere. The National Press Club, everywhere.
Yeah.
And there'll be top lawyers. There'll be some government people there. There'll be some staffers there. There'll be just, you know, a whole bunch of different people there. If you have an issue that's important to you, you'll want to have people there talking to at the relevant events, talking to people about the issue that matters to you.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be bumping into the people who also care about that issue. And the congressmen and the staffers who are at that also to talk are going to be people who care about that issue. And that's the way it's done. You'll go, what Congressman Massey told me when I interviewed him was, he said, the way to affect change is not to go on a tour of the Capitol, get on a bus tour, or buy a plane ticket to go tour the Capitol. It's buy a ticket to a fundraiser in your congressman's district.
Right.
Because the congressman will shake everybody's hand before they leave.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going to have a minute, 2 minutes to say whatever you want to say. You're going to actually get FaceTime with the congressman rather than go into the office here at the Capitol Hill where you might only see staffers. So there's some things you can do that really can get your issue in front. So one of the things that, you know, the people who, you know, these aforementioned people we were talking about,
they know how
to do that.
Yeah. And I guess some of that implies that, you know, the members of Congress really do care. It's not that they... That's right.
And so that's also one of the things that, you know, somebody who really kind of knows the lay of the land, they will help you kind of devise a strategy, you know, and they'll say, well, these are the members that really care about this issue. And this is what you have to do. You need to get to this person and this person. And if they care, then, you know, then you can work on getting others to care, you know, and so it has to be sort of like a snowball going downhill.
Yeah.
You know, because most organizations don't have a limitless amount of money to just throw at things.
Yeah.
And you don't need to have a limitless amount of money to throw at things. You need to have a thought out plan as to how to go about doing it.
Right. I mean, an interesting dynamic with IP issues, one is that you discussed, it obviously doesn't get the same kind of coverage as other issues. But another is there's no clear partisan or ideological divide on these issues.
Right.
Part of it is that, you know, most members of Congress probably don't really know what a patent is or whatever.
Right.
So I guess how does that play into the divisive strategy?
You know, and that is a very interesting question because one of the things, if there is no other side to something that is happening, then the members who don't know what a patent is are going to go along with what is the wave.
Yeah.
And I've been told that. And the way that people might say, oh, well, that's terrible. Think about it for a second. There's so much that goes on in governing our government, right? So these members, even assuming that all of them really care and are there to do a good job and not just to give media interviews or raise money or whatever, let's say that all of them are trying to do a good job. there's so many other things that they are assigned to do that they have to then allow members who are tasked with the IP policy to do their work and then report back and inform them about what they need to know and what they should be thinking and doing, right?
Yeah.
So that's what the other, having an alternative vision about IP matters so much about, is because back when you would only have like the large Silicon Valley view of IP, you were seeing it was easy to get it through because the members who were disengaged on IP, and maybe they were engaged on agriculture or they were engaged on national security or whatever they were engaged in, they would look to the people who are engaged on IP and say, oh, well, we got near unanimity over here because all we're seeing is the tech sector coming. And that's why it was so critical that when the patent system seemed to be whittling away, all the people who needed strong patent rights weren't coming out and saying something.
Yeah. And when do you, I guess, what point of time do you think it did become just predominantly big tech companies who were involved in, involved in educating members of Congress on these issues, well, or policymakers on these issues?
Certainly, when this started getting momentum and getting across the finish line, you know, because...
You're talking about the AIA?
The AIA. Yeah. You know, I mean, that...
So that's like the...
It got passed in 2010, yeah. Or 2011 is when it went into force. Yeah. So you're talking about 2009, 2010 is when it really started getting that momentum. And I think what was happening is a lot of people just thought, oh, you know, it's not going to happen. You know, a lot of these changes are just radical. They're too much. And patent attorneys are notoriously head down doing the work and so much work and just doing, you know, not, and it's not a bad thing, right? You know, you got clients, you got deadlines, you got things to do.
Well, there was a theory, I guess it's played out, that it might be good for patent attorneys.
It certainly has been, right? But now I think one of the problems has been that a lot of the people who cared a lot about this not going to hell,
you
know, my terms, were told by their attorneys not to say anything.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, hey, you own patents, you're in litigation, you're in licensing, you don't want to be out there as the poster child for this patent troll, you know.
Yeah.
So they didn't say anything. And so many people didn't say anything, and then nobody stepped up to say anything.
Yeah.
And what I saw with IP Watchdog was we couldn't get anybody to say anything. And then when they were ready to say something, they would have lost the litigation, and now they're a bitter inventor who lost.
Right.
And you need to be involved ahead of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and the other thing too that people need to know is you need to be involved early. It's just like people hear, you'll hear this, if you haven't heard it already, you'll start to hear this soon with the 2020 election.
Yeah.
Early money defines candidates.
Right.
Right. And then you'll be at a certain point in time when the candidates will have been so thoroughly defined that you'll need an overwhelming amount of money, and it may be too late to change the narrative.
Yeah.
Right? Well, that's true with legislation. You got to get in early. And by the time most people know that the train is running and it's likely going to happen, it's too late to affect it.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's made up their mind. Promises have been made. Deals have been cut. You know, the language has been parsed. We'll change this word to this and that word to that. You know, I'll vote on this if you vote on this for me over here. You know, what any of the deals that might need to be made have been made by the time a lot of people clue in. So that's why if it matters to you, you got to get involved very early in the process.
And I guess my sense is that, I guess, people from the pro-patent side of those issues, if that's a fair characterization, they've learned that lesson since AIA. Is that your...
Yeah, I think that they have. And it seems like they have with respect to the 101 stuff, because they participated in the roundtables.
Yeah.
Now, the question will become, I don't know. I mean, I wonder in D.C. whether you can take a half a loaf of bread. You know, I mean, back in the day, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, they used to talk about this. You know, it's better to have a half a loaf of bread than no loaf of bread at all.
Right.
So if I can't get 100% of the legislation I want, I'll take 50%, and then I'll just circle back and keep trying to get what I want.
Yeah.
And I wonder if in D.C. if that's possible anymore. And I think sometimes the enemy, how did President Obama put it? The enemy of the perfect is the good.
Yeah.
You know, so if it's good, you don't want it unless it's perfect.
Yeah.
And I think we may need to look at this and take the, well, it's good.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back and try and make it perfect next.
So you would take that?
If it was the only thing on the table, I would take it.
I guess another thing, and I kind of want to, from both angles, but discuss is obviously Congress plays an important role, the courts play an important role, but at the end of the day, it's really the director of a USPTO who has a lot of actually influence in how these post-grant proceedings got implemented, how patents get granted and so forth. I guess your view is within the executive branch, how influential is the USPTO director? Is he kind of taking the calls from the White House? Is he following directions from the White House? Or it varies administration to administration?
That certainly varies administration to administration. There have been administrations that probably couldn't have found the patent office with a map. And there's been administrations that literally called the patent office every day for an update.
Yeah. And obviously, I think one of the great things that you did, I think for the Trump administration, there was a lot of speculation about who would be the USPTO director. Director Yanko, I don't think he had much of a track record.
Yeah.
Overall, I think a lot of people have been pleasantly surprised when he came out and expressed his views. But how do you think it's played out? Is there anything that has, I guess, pleasantly surprised you or disappointed you about the Trump administration in general and maybe Director Yanko?
Well, I mean, I think so. We probably need to just limit ourselves to patent policy when we're talking about the Trump administration. Yeah. But I think...
I meant patent policy.
Right, yeah. Because that's a much longer conversation. But I think Director Yanko has brought a lot of hope, and he started talking about patents in a very different way. And that was very welcome. And I've been surprised at just how willing he has been to move on 101. And, you know, the Berkheimer memo, I mean, let's not forget, Berkheimer and Atrix, those were litigation cases.
Yeah.
If the patent office really didn't want to follow them, they didn't have to follow them.
Yeah.
You know, because they always tell us all the time that, you know, in litigation cases, they don't have to follow the courts. They can have more restrictive view.
Yeah.
And they did. They said, look, if these are facts, then it should be a fact when we're determining them the same way. And I think he came out when he was looking at the revised guidance at the beginning of 2019, which was really to look at 2A. I think that's a really good way to look at the step 2A of the Alice Mayo framework, you know, practical application. Because after all, these are inventions. They're supposed to be practical applications of something.
Yeah.
And if they are, I don't understand how a practical application can be abstract.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think he's hit exactly the right notes on 101. I think his hands are probably a lot more tied on 101 with the life sciences, because the Supreme Court has so screwed up the life sciences industry. But so I give him all the props for 101, and I give him tremendous amount of props for going to Congress and saying, look, you've got to do something about this.
Right.
I have been recently critical of him with respect to the PTAB, you know, and people were telling me for a long time I was letting it slide and, you know, giving him a pass. And I was, because, you know, you got to give the guy a chance. You got to give him some time. 18 months in now, a little more than 18 months in, approaching 19 months in, I think I would have expected more to be done on the PTAB. Now, having said that, and after I wrote that article, obviously, and there was no causal connection because it was in the works, we have had a POP decision. Yeah. And I think that went good. That was a pro-patent POP decision. I'm surprised there haven't been more of them.
And sorry, can you just describe what the POP is?
Yeah. The POP is the Presidential Opinion Panel.
Yeah.
So one of the problems that the PTAB has is there's now 270 plus or minus judges on the PTAB. And the way that the PTAB has evolved to get things to be presidential, and I may have the percentages wrong, but it's pretty close. To have it be informative, I think they need to have something like 2/3 of the judges agree.
Oh.
And then to have it be precedential, I think it's 3/4 of the judges agree. Yeah. Now, when you have 270 judges, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, you can't do that, you know? So the pop comes into being, and it's Director Iancu, Commissioner Drew Hirschfeld. Yeah.
And Director Iancu is the one who came up with this
idea. And his initiative. So it's him, Commissioner Drew Hirschfeld, and PTAV Chief Scott Bolick.
Yeah.
And they're a panel. And so you can appeal from a PTAV decision to the pop. And if the pop takes it, whatever the pop decides becomes precedential for all of the PTAV.
Yeah.
Now, I get that, you know, it takes time to have these decisions appealed and decisions hearings heard and then the decisions issued. But it was my understanding as well that Director Iancu reserved for him the ability to just designate more decisions as precedential.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's done that. So, like, the one big one that really sticks in my craw is with Unified Patents. And it's not just Unified. I guess it's RPX. It's any of those collectors, what I'll call, you know, and collectors. I call them collectors because they collect the money from all these other people to challenge patents. But all the people that they collect the money from are not considered by the PTAB to be real parties in interest. Now, I get the argument. I understand that they have a Chinese wall in place, they say, where those people that they give them the money are not in control of the litigation.
Yeah.
But according to the Federal Circuit decision that Judge O'Malley wrote, it depends upon who gets the benefit of the outcome of these decisions. That's how you determine who the real party in interest is.
Yeah.
And that was always my understanding going back to Wright and Miller, the federal treatise on procedure, you know? And the benefit from these decisions clearly inured to the people who are paying Unifieds of the world to challenge these patents and IPR. So I don't understand why the people who are paying are not real parties in interest. And that really just, I mean, because the problem becomes we were told that these IPR challenges were going to have real estoppel. If you lost, there was going to be real estoppel.
Yeah.
But there is no real estoppel.
So that is that's the issue, is that these patents can be challenged and then the actual party, real party of interest, can then go ahead
and challenge them again.
Again and again,
you know. And I just think at some point in time, the patent office needs to follow the Federal Circuit. Look, I mean, I think the Federal Circuit makes plenty of bad decisions.
Yeah.
Here's one that makes all the sense in the world because it's what we know to be true from every other area of law that has ever looked at what it means to be a real party in interest. And Judge O'Malley's decision and the name of the case is escaping me at the moment, but I can put my finger on it. I've written about it. She wrote about the real party in interest, and she explained it. You know, going back to the treatises and the cases, you know, that explain it, and that has been my understanding. And that's why I was always very upset about that, because it allows for these patents to be challenged over and over again. And the other thing, too, is there are some portfolios, and the one I've written about a number of times is FinJan, because I'm more familiar with their portfolio than others. They've been challenged. They've won 80 times.
Yeah.
They have 29 patents or thereabouts. They've won 80 times. I think they have like 50 pending cases still going on. At what point in time is it harassing?
Yeah. So from what I understand, I was actually going to ask you, if you could fix one thing about the PTAB, what would it be? It seems if we're going to have a PTAB, let's just have a estoppel and let's not be able to challenge DC patents over and over again.
I think if I only had one thing, I'd probably fudge this, right? My one thing would be fixing the estoppel, right? Because then that might be like a tentacle and go out in a couple different ways.
Right.
Because then I think that would have to, I see it in a couple different ways, because you'd have to do something about the harassing challenges,
right?
And you would have to do something about real party and interest, you know? And those, I think, are two big issues. And you'd also have to do the serial challenges, which is also, that's really the harassment, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe not, that's a version of the harassment, maybe not all the harassment.
Well, it's really, sometimes it's the threat of the PTAB challenges.
Yeah. Well, but the thing too is, you know, I don't get the PTAB, you know, like, if you and I mean, we're both attorneys, we both carry the ethical chain, ball and chain around with us, like every other attorney out there.
Yeah.
And if we have a conflict, we can't represent. And the conflict, we can't erase a conflict. We carry it our whole career. And at the PTAB, they've had judges decide decisions dealing with former clients that they've litigated on behalf of.
Yeah.
And I thought that they had stopped doing that. And just a week or two ago, a few weeks ago, I was alerted to the fact that, no, again, another APJ was assigned to another Apple case, and she's represented Apple in litigation before. And we wrote about that a couple years ago. And it's like, I don't get these unforced errors by the PTAB is why people like me and others look at this court and say, well, if they're doing these things, what else are they doing?
I was actually going to ask you, because to me, it's just so odd, you know, like reassign these PTAB judges to other cases. Why even create this appearance that there might be some kind of something off? I mean, do you have any sense? Is it just incompetence, like you say?
I have no idea. I mean, I think that what I had talked to a number of older judges from the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences, most of them, I think the ones I had talked to were retired, and they talked to me back then a couple years ago when we started writing about this, and I was writing like, why doesn't the PTAB have a rule of conduct, code of conduct for the judges? And a couple of them reached out to me, and they all said the same thing. And I said, don't forget, the way that you became a judge on the board was you were an employee of the patent office, usually for 20 years or more.
Yeah.
And then you got promoted to the board. So if you had had any conflict, which likely you didn't, it was probably a generation old.
Yeah.
You know, and so there was really no need to have, because you'd been working for the office forever.
Yeah.
You know, in one capacity or another. And then when it becomes the PTAB,
right,
and they go out and they hire a bunch of attorneys who were just yesterday representing clients, it was just an oversight.
Yeah.
But at what point in time does that oversight not become excusable? I mean,
I'm just thinking of one of the judges that you wrote about. He went back to work for the client.
Oh my God. I mean, that and you can't make that up, right? Yeah. He was a litigator at a firm litigating on behalf of Apple.
Yeah.
Then decided over 25 cases in which Apple was the petitioner. And in those 25 cases, Apple won over 96% of them. And then when I wrote about this,
yeah,
he was removed from all the Apple cases. Then he shortly thereafter left. And then Apple hired him. You can't make this stuff up.
It must be some kind of signal. I don't know.
I mean, you know, but this is the thing. Look, you try, because, you know, you don't want to attribute malice.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe it's happenstance. Maybe people just didn't know. But my God, the optics are terrible. And, you know, and some of this is a new problem for the patent office.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of companies now that have an awful lot of data, and it's thanks to Google. Yeah. And not just Google, but others. Google's picked it up, and there's been other companies that, through the invitation from the patent office, and just really, this was a good service Google did for all of us.
Yeah.
Is they, for a period of years, were scraping data off the patent office servers with the permission of the patent office, and creating this corpus of raw data. And now there's so much of this raw data that's out there that you have LexisNexis and, for example, and many other companies that have access to this data, and they're creating interesting new ways to drill down this data and search it that we would never have known about a lot of this stuff before.
Yeah.
So it is a fresh new day for the patent office to have to become better at dealing with optics, I think.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, we started this discussion about talking why patents are important. You know, startups need them. And then we talked about a lot of the issues, I guess, and the problems. And you've been watching it pretty closely over the last 20 years. I mean, what is your prediction about where we'll be maybe in the next 20 years with the patent system?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean...
Or I guess any thoughts about the field and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we're not going to just do away with the patent system in the U.S., it's going to have to be resolved here over the next several years to come more in line with the rest of the world, ironically, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because more is patent eligible in Europe and in China than it is in the U.S., at least in the software area, for sure, and maybe also in the life sciences area, in certain pockets of the life sciences area. Certainly in medical diagnostics, you know, and that's scary. I mean, because if you can't diagnose it, you can't treat it. And that really is worrisome. So I do have faith that we're going to get this right. but it's probably going to take another couple years, 2 to 3 years, to get it right.
Yeah, which isn't bad.
Which isn't so bad in the broader picture of things, yeah. Right? But where are we going to be? I mean, I don't know that we're ever going to be back in the heydays of the dot-com era, you know, but or back when, you know, people were paying like ridiculous amounts of money for questionable patent portfolios. But because we have the computers are involved now, right? You know, yeah. As computers are getting involved and the prior art searching gets better, the quality of the patents ought to get better. And what really should be happening is people should be looking at this and say, you know, I can see a point in time here in a not too distant future where people like you and me that have been telling our clients, look, don't get more patents, get better patents.
Yeah.
That has to become the rule. You know, and it's not just you and I are going to be talking about that, because it's that if you're not doing that pretty soon, you're going to be spending stupid money.
Yeah.
Because examiners have to have algorithms helping them with 112 rejections.
Yeah.
How else are they given these 15, 18 pages of 112 rejections?
Right.
Because we know they don't read the specification.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so it's working its way into the patent office. Finding prior art's going to get better with better search algorithms. AI is going to become smarter. How soon it actually becomes true artificial intelligence that we can leverage, I don't know. But, you know, a lot of things are going to be changing. And if we don't look at ways to plant those seeds now, then I think we're going to wind up being lost moving forward in the future.
But it seems overall, you're pretty optimistic. If we're going to get higher quality patents in the future, you know, they're going to be more reliable. Hopefully we'll...
Yeah, you know. I am. The one caveat is I think we have to do something about this, what I refer to as this sharing economy. Because the sharing economy, I think, is a problem, right? You know, because it really drives all the way down to the way people think. Kids think and grow up expecting everything to be available for free.
Yeah.
And things are not free, you know, and we know that now. The currency of the internet is your email address, your name, and them spying on you so they know what your preferences are for absolutely everything.
Yeah.
So it's not free, but people want everything for free, and they're willing to give up their privacy to get that, which is a longer conversation on the privacy angle. But what is that doing for content creators, for artists, and for inventors?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's going to make it harder and harder for people who are trying to monetize their original creations, whatever that winds up being, to do that moving forward.
Yeah.
So I do think we need to educate. And that's why I was so upset with what was going on during the second Obama term, when I thought that there was just this sense that innovation was going to happen.
Yeah.
Innovation has never just happened. People have to spend a lot of time and energy to do it.
Yeah.
And if we don't have that built into our DNA and we expect things to be available for free and we have all the systems to be able to take it and steal it and share it without paying for it, I don't know where that leaves creators. We see where it's left content creators and artists and so forth. A lot of people that are the average salary for people who are authors is below the poverty line.
Yeah. So I think if anything, your concern is more really the fundamentals of a respect to why we have the patent system.
Right.
It's not the, you know, the 101, whatever 101 we'll figure out, but it's really, you know, why we have this patent system in the first place.
That's right. And I see like some existential threats, you know, like, and I don't want to pay any more for drugs than I have to.
Yeah.
But when I feel really bad, I want the drug to work.
Right.
You know, and if you look at WHO has over, it's like 400, 410 in that ballpark of the essential drugs in the world.
Yeah.
And 96 or 97% of them were once patented.
Yeah.
Now, if you couldn't get a patent on these drugs, there's no way you could invest enough money to bring them to market.
Right.
And here, every year anymore, it seems like we talk about taking away drug patents. Well, do we really want to take away drug patents and have fewer drugs? Because that's the outcome.
Yeah.
I think what we ought to be trying to figure out is how to get more drugs, not fewer drugs.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like, I don't see anybody really seriously talking about bacteria-resistant diseases, you know, like MRSA.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that I think is a real problem, you know, or like the, you know, every once in a while you'll see like in the science media, we'll talk about when is the next avian flu going to decimate the planet? Well, why are we in the IP community not having that same kind of conversation? You know, because if we're not incentivizing innovation, we're not going to be ready.
Yeah.
And I think we're not only not incentivizing it, we're actually talking about dismantling it. And that just seems foolhardy to me.
Yeah.
Now, I get that we want to do something on the cost containment side, but can we please not throw away our future in order to contain costs?
Right.
There's got to be other ways that we can contain costs that don't kill innovation.
Yeah. That hopefully is definitely an important answer for that. I want to end with two hopefully fun last questions.
Okay, sure.
I guess what advice would you give to a young lawyer who wants to be the next Gene Quinn, who wants to be influential on the IP policy front?
Well, I don't know that I would advise anybody to go on my path because it's been a sort of a circuitous path. But what I would do is say is you have to get involved. And I think you do have to have an opinion. One thing I did very early on is one of the firms that I was with, I started trying to bring in clients to the firm, and I was told that I didn't need to worry about bringing in clients. I just needed to do the work I was told to do.
Yeah.
And then I left shortly thereafter because you can't find yourself stagnate. You're going to be as good as valued based on the clients that you have and the clients that you can bring in and what you bring to the table. And I do fundamentally think people like to work with people they like, particularly in our space. You know, they have something in common with you. Maybe they're like the same video games. Maybe they coded. Maybe you coded.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you have the same common experiences in labs, whatever it is. Find that commonality and build around it because there's enough people like you. And that will be good. And then as you're doing that along the way, don't be afraid. Go to these conferences and conventions and meet people. And if you're young and you're doing that, you're going to stand out because there's not a lot of people that do that. And I see, you know, like I go to these events and there's a large one will be like 500, 600, 700 attorneys.
Yeah.
Well, how many attorneys? I mean, there's got to be 40,000 plus patent attorneys in the U.S. right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a small number of people.
Yeah.
So participate. Show up, listen, and if something interests you, ask questions, talk to people, and be known.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. And then what you do with that from there, maybe you get clients, maybe you make connections, but have fun along the way.
That's great advice.
And I there may have been another thing, but I think that's probably the best thing. Have fun along the way and be true to yourself.
And I guess a question for you, if you didn't end up following your path in retrospect, is there any other career path that you might have been interested in?
Interesting. I don't know that I've ever been asked that question. You know, it's funny how things wind up working. You know, I never really wanted to be a patent prosecutor.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where I landed, I suppose. I took the patent bar so I could call myself a patent attorney because I wanted to do, you know, litigation. And I have thought a lot about, you know, at some point in time, I do kind of hope that I have the ability, you know, the economic freedom to be able to go and take on some of these cases where I think there's wrongs that are going on.
Right.
And try and right them. And we might be trying to start to do some of that a little bit with IP Watchdog. I think in 2020, we're going to try and start with doing some amicus stuff, maybe.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
But try and get involved there. But, you know, it would have been legally related, I suppose. Or, you know, oh, okay, I know what the answer is.
Do you file an amicus because they read your blog?
Yeah, no, I know, right? I know what it is. You know, I've always wanted to own a, because I was a short order cook when I was in college, paying the bills. I've always kind of wanted to have a restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, so if I wasn't a lawyer at all, that's what I'd probably be doing.
That's good.
Yeah, I'd be a restaurateur.
Any particular cuisine or?
Well, I've always wanted to have like just a place, you know, like a sports bar, you know, where people just really like to go and have good food and have a drink. And it's just be a comfortable place where everybody can go and, you know, not like Cheers, but you know, where people know your name, you know, where you're everybody's welcome, you know, that sort of thing.
Fits with their personality.
Yeah.
I guess one question does occur to me, one last one. You said you've bought an IP Watchdog with 10 of your other buddies.
Yeah.
What do they think of what it's become?
Yeah, they're very complimentary, you know. And it's funny, we're on this chat group with a lot of them still. Yeah. And I'm still in touch with those guys, and you know, those are life friends. You know, yeah. they went off to do, you know, different things, and so we are still very close. But yeah, no, they're pleased, I think, with what we're doing.
That's great. All right, thanks again.
Sure, thanks, Eli.
This is lots of fun.